Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Aintibar, which is, of course, Arabic for acting. I'm sure we've done
is
that one
really?
Before. I don't
Aintibar.
Know.
Aintibar.
I'm sure we've done it before and I've made a mess of it before. So our apologies to our Arabic listener. it is, of course, a momentous 48 hours, 80 years ago in June 1942, that saw the fall of Tobruk to German forces under Erwin Rommel, with 25,000 Allied soldiers going into the bag. Rommel was promoted to the rank of field marshal as a reward for his success. I bet he got a few quid, as well, a few Reichsmarks as well, didn't he? Because they Hitler tended to bung people money if they did well. And in Europe, Vichy Prime Minister... And in Europe, Vichy Prime Minister Pierre Laval told the French nation, I would wish for a German victory, because without it, Bolshevism tomorrow would settle everywhere.
Well, this was the travail obligataire, and it was done on the anniversary, two-year anniversary of the armistice, which, as you can imagine, was not a really good political move.
Timing.
I just feel that Laval didn't really have the political instinct, if I'm honest.
I don't know if he had any options, really, did he? And he was playing a very thin deck. Anyway, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. June 1942, for the...
big month.
Well, big month, and also, you know, you think of 1942, where 1942 starts and where 1942 ends.
Yeah, it's a tale of 2 years.
It really is
in
the
one.
The turnaround is gigantic, and if you were a declinist, you could take 2/3 of 1942 and go, look, you see, there it all is. That's all you need.
And it has been said. It's been done. Let's face it.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if you're of the non-declinist, you know, once the Allies get their act together, school. Because I think I fall into that camp, that the Allies are really rubbish to start with.
I don't think they are. I think it's the army command in the desert is rubbish, which I don't think is quite the same thing. Because I think actually the kit they've got is pretty good. They've got six pounders. They've got, you know, Grants. They've got 25 pounders. They've got really good guns. They've got plenty of 3.7 inches in the Delta in Egypt, which could have been used in an anti-tank role, which should have been in the desert, but weren't. They've got most of the men are pretty well trained. They're pretty up for it. Good Commonwealth forces, smattering of South Africans, smattering New Zealanders, Australians.
But morale's like a rubber band. Sort of.
That's the problem. And why is it like a rubber band? It's because they're led by idiots. And you know, people don't have a clue.
You haven't been reading Francis Tucker lately, have you, by any chance?
What? No. He says, picking up Approach to Battle by Sir Francis Tucker.
Snap.
My copy was originally owned by John G. Holland's BHQ 80-90 battery, 1st Field Regiment, RA, 4th Indian Division.
Oh, that's interesting. Mine doesn't have a... mine's from the... Kent County Library, Kent Council, Kent Education Committee. It came from the second half from the library. It doesn't seem to belong to anyone. But I mean, I wonder how we get this back into print. It's a gripping read. Yearly we've ridden the Jebel Stakes. Yearly fought back on our course. Yearly we've made the same silly mistakes. Overridden a failing horse. At a fence too stiff for his strength to leap, with a rotten takeoff, unfirm, too steep, heavily breasted the top of the bank. Pawed, gasped and struggled, then hopelessly sank, shocked, hurt and surprised at the loss we took, rolling back adown the ditch at Tobruk. The Jebel Stakes, 1942-41 by Francis Tucker.
That's terrific, but the beginning of chapter 6, I think, is... You know, you can see that Gertie is—that's his nickname—wasn't mincing his words. If the approach to battle is good, the battle is easy. The Battle of Gazala was opened by Rommel attacking on the 27th of May. This was one of the worst fought battles in the history of the British Army, and it's hard to disagree. Every time I think about Gazala, and I've written about it in books twice,
yeah,
well, three times if you consider Ladybird experts as well. It's a hard experience. It's tough as a Brit to kind of be able to write this because you have to just put your hands up and go, that was a shocker.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the football team that's got all the stars. They're turning up against Iceland and they lose 3-0 because they're just not coming to the party, even though they've got all the support staff, all the training, everything that says it should be 5-0 the other way around.
But I mean, what's interesting though is he is Tuca is you know, he's convinced that Auchinleck is the greatest fighting general the British Army ever had, isn't he?
And well, he says he's right about everything.
Well, nobody says Auchinleck fights Rommel to a complete standstill, right?
Yeah.
And then he's sent back to a desk.
Yeah.
And he says if only Auchinleck had stayed, you know, if he'd stayed and if he'd led his army, then Rommel would never have made any of the gains that he made at Gazala. If the Orc had been, he calls him the greatest fighting soldier, the British fighting general the British Army ever had. The only person to have scored a victory against the Germans in British High Command. He goes on and on about it in these tones in this same book, and then of course he's sent to his desk and he's gone and Ritchie takes over, who he almost doesn't even name, which I think is really, really
he can't
bring himself to say it, which I think is sort of fascinating.
Well, let's be kind to Auchinleck for a bit because the enormity of the Middle East Command is a massive burden.
Well,
Middle East Command is not just Egypt. It's also East Africa. Yeah. It's also Sudan. It's also Iraq, Palestine, Jordan. Yeah.
But that's Tuca's point, though, isn't it? You've got a brilliant fighting soldier and you give him basically a staff job.
Yes.
You give him an overseeing role.
You know. Yeah, and I think that was a colossal mistake. And I do think he's not a bad fighting general. And after all, you know, he does quite well at the First Battle of Alamein. And of course, once he's given the tick-tock, once he's fired, he's, you know, that command is broken up.
Yeah, yeah. Here it is. Here we go. Auchinleck was bred for the battlefield, and there he should have stayed until he was worn out with fighting. This is page 19. 20 other generals could have conducted the affairs of GHQ Middle East, but it is doubtful if we then possessed one other man who could have successfully fought the battles of manoeuvre, which in any case were yet to come in North Africa. He had, in most adverse circumstances, given Rommel a hammering that capable general would never forget. Surely common sense and the national interest dictated that if Rommel was ever to be fought again, he should be fought by the man who had already lowered his colours, who had once shattered his confidence in himself, the man who had defeated him.
Well, that's not a. I mean, I don't entirely disagree with that at all, to be honest. And had Auchinleck just been left to command 8th Army, it probably would have been a very, very different story. I don't think. Yeah. I don't think Gazala would have happened. And yet he allows Ritchie to create the Gazala line. He doesn't stop him. And it is the Orc who appoints Ritchie.
Yeah.
And obviously, making appointments isn't being a brilliant fighting general. That's more of an admin job. But I think you can argue that as Tuca does, that he's a good fighting general, but a hopeless pen pusher.
I mean,
it's
Tuca though thinks the whole thing's rotten. Though he says one recollects the motto for our work at the Camberley Staff College in the mid-20s was speed with accuracy. And that was a very good motto, so long as one learnt to put speed first when on the battlefield. One's own advice to one's staff or commander is 75% right and in time is better than 100% right. So he's saying basically there's this sort of, you know, people bad at drafting orders, wanting everything tidy, not being prepared to make decisions. It's the thing that Tuca also is concerned about, that they've got this Gazala line plan and they're stuck in it. Whether they've got the initiative or whether they feel that they've got the latitude to change it. I mean, basically, his whole thing is that the division is your, you know, your battlefield molecule, isn't it? And anything smaller isn't up to the job.
I think we should explain what is going on.
Yes, why not? Yeah.
So everyone talks about the Jebel Stakes, and the Jebel Stakes is this idea that the territory in the North African campaign on one level doesn't really matter because there's not a lot in it. Yeah. So to a certain extent, it's sort of slightly academic. And what happens is it sort of ding-dongs back and forth. And in the summer of 1941, Wavell is in command and he launches an attack to try and put... Well, first of all, the British in launched their attack against the Italians in December 1940. It's Operation Compass. They pushed the Italians all the way back out of Egypt, all the way across Libya, around the kind of bulge of Cyrenaica, which includes Tobruk and Benghazi and Sirte, all these places that we've heard in the
news.
And
this is O'Connor, of course.
And this is Dick O'Connor. Yeah. And then in February 1941, Hitler sends Rommel with first two divisions and then a third division, which is the Africa Corps.
Yeah.
And his instructions are to stay where he is and just defend it and make sure that the Allies don't push all the way through to Libya and get Tripoli, which is at the western end of Libya.
So what you have there is orders from Hitler that make sense. I just want to flag that up for the listener. We found a peculiar moment in German military.
That actually makes the right decision. But the beauty of it is that Rommel ignores that and then goes on the offensive and pushes the Eighth Army back very quickly. And the reason the Eighth Army goes back is because they've just diverted half of what was then the Western Desert Fort. It wasn't even called Eighth Army at that point. The Western Desert Fort has been diverted to Greece because the Germans have also invaded the Balkans and Greece at the same time.
Yeah.
So shorn of their number.
Which is a terrible, terrible decision by Hitler. There we go. Just to restore to restore the balance.
Which is a terrible decision.
Just in case you thought he was getting good at this.
Yeah. So that's a really bad idea. And in the process of pushing the Western Desert Force back, O'Connor gets taken prisoner.
Yeah.
And I think it's either O'Connor's or Neame's goggles, which Rommel takes off him and then wears on his cap for the rest evermore. And then in the summer, Wavell tries to then counterattack again, which is Battle Axe.
Yes.
And makes a small amount of ground, but doesn't relieve Tobruk, which has been captured in April, I think, 1941.
Yeah,
and Tobruk is besieged. It hasn't been captured. It's besieged. That's right. It's been skirted round, and it is besieged. So this is the siege of Tobruk. And then later on, then Wavell gets sacked.
Yeah,
Auchinleck takes over and mounts this massive offensive in November 1941, which is pretty successful.
Operation Crusader. It's not just pretty successful. I mean, it's arguably, it shows that everything works. It shows that you can attack. It shows that the kit is still up to date and good enough in the different. Because after all, what one of the massive issues in the desert is that you've got kit that's essentially been designed for fighting in Northwest Europe with, and now you're fighting in a different terrain, which emphasizes different pros and cons to your weapon system. Yep. So range, for instance, is suddenly a massive issue because you've got wide open spaces with not very much cover, and the range of your artillery really is the thing that suddenly becomes that matters more than anything else.
Yes, but it's no longer the tank; it's the anti-tank gun is the preeminent weapon.
And the range of the anti-tank gun and what the anti-tank gun can achieve without cover, basically,
is
what it suddenly all becomes about.
Yeah,
and yet they do, and yet Crusader, arguably, there's a big wobble in the middle of Crusader, isn't there?
Yeah.
But arguably, it's a successful battle for the British. But what they draw from it, morale-wise, is, oh God, the Germans are very difficult to fight. Our kit isn't very good. Our tanks aren't reliable. Our anti-tank guns aren't very good. They draw an extraordinary set of conclusions from what is essentially a victory, don't they? Which is really interesting, isn't it?
It is really interesting. But I think that you have the seeds of that dissatisfaction, that dip in morale in Crusader. At the end of Crusader, because it's been a really bloody brutal affair.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole battle of it, and also it is like a sort of, it's ships manoeuvring on a sea because there's no hedgerows and there's no towns and there's no villages. Yeah. And it's just a wide open nothingness. Yeah. It feels like you're sort of manoeuvring around on a sea. And so the battlefield is just pockmarked with burnt out tanks and so on. But I think where the morale really takes a dip is that Crusader is seen as this monumental effort. And it was supposed to completely rout the Africa Corps and their Italian allies.
Yeah.
And it's a victory in so much that it pushes them back. Tobruk is relieved. But it isn't conclusive. It isn't the kind of...
Yeah.
It's it isn't nearly, a definite...
Nearly, it's, but it's, not quite. Yeah.
It's a nearly, but not quite. And what then happens in the early part of 1942 is that Rommel then counterattacks again.
Yeah. Well, he has a sort of sniff.
Pushes them back.
He has a sniff, doesn't he?
Yes, but I think that's the fatal blow.
Yeah.
because they suddenly think, crikey, we've just done all this and we've just lost this territory. And there is something completely debilitating about losing the blood of your mates only to, you know.
Yeah.
It's one thing to gain the territory. To then lose it a couple of months later just seems careless.
Even and though in terms of materiel schlacht, you've actually inflicted quite a considerable blow to the enemy. It shows that actually, for all the talk of territory not mattering, it matters enormously if you're thinking in terms of morale. If you go forward 40 miles and then you go back 45, it doesn't matter how hard you duff the enemy up in the process, it doesn't feel like you're winning. Yeah. And I think because Tuca talks about, he talks about territory not mattering, people getting hung up on territory and getting hung up on locations. And what you've got to do is destroy the enemy's army rather than the territory. I think the problem is that intellectually that's absolutely right. But in terms of translation into the morale of your men, that's actually quite a hard sell. It's quite hard to make withdrawals not look like defeats. It's quite a trick to pull, isn't it? To persuade your men that actually, you know, it's okay that we aren't holding the territory we just spent weeks fighting for.
And I think the other point is that within the Eighth Army, the hardcore of the Eighth Army have been at this for a year and a bit.
Yeah.
So they've already been across Cyrenaica and back and forward and back. Yeah. So they've been back twice. And I think that's the problem by the spring of 1942.
Yeah.
Because obviously the people who've been there the longest are now the NCOs. They're the platoon sergeants. They're the they're the section commanders.
Yeah.
And they're the people who are going to go grumbling to the new guys who arrive in. And that's how the contagion of morale dip starts to take root, I think.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you've got this system where by the beginning of kind of April, end of April 1942, you've got a standoff where everyone's a bit exhausted. Everyone's sort of waiting for resupplies to come up.
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of uneasy truce in the desert battle where nothing's really happening. But both sides are sort of building up for the next one. But what the British do is they've got this perfectly good solution, which is to retreat behind Tobruk, because Tobruk has already been defended for 9 months by not very many men.
Yeah.
And so what you've got is a port because it's got your back to the sea. So it means you can constantly be resupplied.
Yeah.
And what you can do is create the lines of Torres Vedras. You can create these defensive positions in a concentric rings around Tobruk with, you know, 180 degrees worth of circle with the sea behind you.
Yeah.
And you can make it absolutely impregnable. And everyone can stay there and Rommel cannot go forward because his lines will overextend and he'll have to turn and deal with Tobruk. But Ritchie,
Rommel doesn't care about overextending his lines. I mean,
he would run out of steam, wouldn't he?
No,
he
this is one of the interesting things about, you know, the last sort of few weeks we've talked about, you know, intelligent people arriving at stupid decisions, you know, intelligent people with all the information at their fingertips arriving at decisions that are kind of unfathomable. And also, but also very often creating circumstances that their enemy will make the most of and unwittingly doing that. Right. And this is a really good example of that. If any other general than Rommel, this might work, right? But you're looking at a general who doesn't care about being overextended, who, if he can defeat you piecemeal, will happily do that. He won't try and encounter you sort of on a sort of peer-to-peer level. If he can direct all his force onto one part of your formation, which is what he proceeds to do, doesn't he? He sort of nips bits off Eighth Army and deals with them separately. If you're dealing with a general who thinks like that, then the Gazala Line plan is entirely is going to fail, whereas someone else with a different way of doing things, it might work perfectly well, and it might serve as a trap that the enemy feeds himself into, and then you can...
Well, yes, so we should explain what the Gazala Line is. Yeah. So the Gazala Line is, instead of Eighth Army falling in behind the new lines of Torres Vedras around Tobruk, what they do is they're about 15 miles to the west of Tobruk, in a line extending north-south from the coast.
In boxes.
About 40 miles.
Yeah.
And a box is, so what you do is you have a concentration of infantry in your box, and the box is surrounded by minefields. And the gap between the next concentration of infantry, the next box, is linked by more minefields and wire.
Yeah.
And you've got it. So you've got the South Africans and Australians in the north. Then you've got the British. And then right at the bottom, you've got the Free French.
Yeah.
You know, again, that's not much. That's not very sensible because there's a sort of uneasy kind of alliance with the Free French.
Yeah.
After what happened to Mera, Kabir and Dunkirk and all the rest of it. Yeah. And they're out on a limb. And the problem with the box system and the line system is, of course, in the desert, can always be outflanked.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what Rommel does. On the 26th of May, he launches his attack, and he just goes round the bottom. So the Italian part of his army attack in the north, and it's a full frontal, whereas the Africa Corps skirts around the back and comes in round the back, where obviously it's not as well defended. Now, the British also don't just have everyone in boxes. They also have mobile units, including 7th Armoured Division.
Yeah.
And the Armoured Division is sort of there. It's a mobile reserve.
Yeah,
and should have sandwiched the Africa Corps between the two, between the boxes and the mobile 7th Armoured Division. Yeah. But it doesn't happen because all the different corps commanders and divisional commanders are all bickering with each other, and they're really, really slow.
Yeah.
And so they don't respond quick enough.
Well,
and by the time they have responded, it's too late.
Speed and accuracy.
Everything about the battle is badly fought. The line is a ill-conceived concept for the forces he's got and the commanders he's got. And their response to the situation in which they find themselves is absolutely abject. It is, I really think it's, I don't think you can count Singapore because they barely fight and they've got ill-trained troops and they've got no kit, you know, so it sort of almost doesn't count. But Ghazala, they've got all the kit. They've got amazing resources, and there is absolutely no excuse for it whatsoever. So for me, that is the nadir of the British Army in the Second World War. It's appalling.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll take a break while you savour that thought, ladies and gentlemen, like a glass of fine red wine, and swirl it around your brains, and we'll be back in a second. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. James Holland has just done an on that bombshell for us there with the worst moment of the British Army's, worst performance of the British Army in the Second World War. I'll tell you what we'll do before we resume the Battle of the Ghazala Line. A little bit of housekeeping. I mean, all this sunshine would be a timely reminder to those of you who are still without tickets for We Have Ways Fest, our summer festival taking place between Friday, July the 22nd to Sunday, July the 24th. 3 days of war waffle, prime cuts as well. Not one of those ground up burger type cuts, the finest steak. Latest news is that the We Have Ways modelling community are bringing their own gazebo to enable us to join the fruits of their labour. Fantastic. I love a gazebo. I looked after a gazebo for a friend once because he got divorced and we got given the gazebo, one of those fold-up things. And I put it up and then I tried to take it down and it ended up going to the tip.
So they're kind of sort of...
One-shot device.
One-shot erection.
Exactly. Kitoff 22 is currently being judged. A terrific amount of money has been raised for victims of the war in Ukraine. Well done, and thank you to everyone who took part. And some of the stuff is absolutely amazing. A big thanks to Simon Red 5 Models for organising that. We'll be announcing the winners soon, and there'll be tons of pictures on Twitter. For the festival, there's 40 speakers booked, 50-plus tanks and assorted military vehicles heading our way, and a wide selection of beers, including Upkeep Ale, that well-known beer, Horsa, and for the discerning, a splendid glass of Mulberry. For details on speakers, hardware, and how to get tickets, go to wehavewaysfest.co.uk. That's wehavewaysfest.co.uk. Advertisement ends. So
let's also not forget that you can also have a pint of Jumping Jim Gavin and
Jumping Jim
Dustbin.
Gavin. Yeah, and Flying Dustbin. I'm looking forward to.
I had a pint of Wur Mahomet.
I think it's the Flying Dustbin that I'm most attracted to for some reason. I don't know why.
It's not the taste, it's just the name.
Exactly. So it's the worst performance by British command in the Second World War. Bizarre.
I think so. There's this amazing photograph that was taken by, I think it was by Cecil Beaton, who was out there following it all and taking photographs. And there's a picture of Neil Ritchie. And let's just say, Neil Ritchie was Auchinleck's chief of staff back at GHQ, and he's a major general, and he's hastily promoted to lieutenant general and pushed in as commander of the 8th Army. And you can say, you know, Gertie can say what he likes about the Auk and his you know, his brilliance on the battlefield. But as an admin man, he's pretty shocking. And this was not a good decision. And the idea was, I've got such a big command, he can basically be my proxy commander out there. I'll do it, but he can just feed stuff back and I'll just advise him. Which is why, ultimately, Orkinet has to take responsibility for Ghazala. Because he's designed it that way and it's failed abysmally. Yeah. And there's this picture taken by Cecil Beaton of Ritchie surrounded by his core commanders, all who hate each other's guts, have no respect for Ritchie because he's been promoted over and above them.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in the middle scratching his head. And it just says it all. I mean, it really, really does. And it's Ritchie simply does not have the authority to kick these Commonwealth, these Duke commanders and give them a kick up the arse and tell them to pull their finger out and bloody get a move on. So it's Lumsden,
but
isn't it?
It's not his style, though, is it? Because Richie's very lucky because he gets a second act, doesn't he?
Yes,
he comes back as a core commander and he does very well. And Ritchie really is a collaborative, his style is sort of collaborative, collegiate and all that. And if the people you're commanding don't engage in that style, you're screwed.
Yes.
If you're the whole way you do things is by arriving at essentially, you know, taking counsel of your commanders and then making decisions. If they won't engage in that, you're absolutely buggered. And I think that's what happens to Ritchie. I think It's as much their fault as his. And again, we've talked about this in the last few weeks about when people arrive at decisions the guy in charge can only really very often make decisions based on what the guys he's commanding tell him and their ability to enact the stuff that he's, you know, when you're in Richie's position, you don't say we're going to do this and everyone jumps. You know, it's what do you think your lads are capable of? And I think one of the interesting things here is that we talk about the state of morale in Eighth Army. How across that is Ritchie? How much does Ritchie know within his grasp of what his men are actually capable of doing? Because one of the things that then happens at the end of 1942, and you know, Tuca's very critical of the way the Alamein battles fought. But what's happening is Montgomery is trying to run a battle within the capabilities of Eighth Army, having looked at what Eighth Army is capable of and what it's not capable of, and how the way to protect your men's morale is to not give them things that they can't do. Because if you give them things they can't do, it does for them morale-wise. And I think you've got that sense that, I mean, I think there is that sense that poor old Ritchie, like you say, his core commanders all hate each other. They hate him. They think he's overpromoted. You're immediately in a difficult situation there. And it's someone else's plan. So he's in this really unenviable position, isn't he?
Yeah, completely. He is. But that's why I've always been quite critical of the Orc, because I think, you know, he put him there. And put him in this invidious situation. And he's totally incapable of gripping the situation. Yeah. And the problem is, I suppose, from Orkinet's point of view, you can't start sort of sacking people mid-battle in the middle of it, because it's all about the here and now. It's not about kind of in 2 days' time.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, this bit from... So Tuca is sitting there twiddling his thumbs. He's got this highly trained 4th India Division who are not really involved.
Yeah.
And so he goes on, 26th of May, I was sent up alone by air from Cairo to the battle area with orders to assume command of the left flank of the army. That is to say, of the Free French at Bir Hakeim, 3rd Indian Motor Brigade, a few miles southeast of them, 7th Motor Brigade at Retma, 15 miles off east, 29th Indian Brigade at El Gubi, some 12 miles further east of Retma. These were, all of them, last man, last round posts. This was irony, as I had always expressed my dislike of these static positions, and it was well known that it was my firm opinion that they should be put on wheels to operate offensively against Rommel, and so, whichever way he came, force him to divert a substantial number of his tanks to the protection of his lines of supply.
Yeah.
And, of course, that doesn't happen. And it turns into there's Knightsbridge, there's the Cauldron. The Cauldron is this sort of low, and it is very, very low, shallow hollow.
Yeah.
Where... the German tanks should have been absolutely destroyed, but they end up doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
And this is because the buffer against the idea is that the infantry boxes are the anvil.
Yeah.
7th Armored Division is the hammer, and it just doesn't work because of the longer range of anti-tank guns, because they just don't organize themselves quickly. And there is these moments where it is absolutely clear that what you need is to strike fast and strike hard.
Yeah.
And the British just don't do it. They just don't do it because of differing, because of fappage,
because the kit. I think the anti-tank gun is, this is actually a moment where the kit is as important as it possibly could be. And this is the thing Tuca keeps coming back to, is that you can make all the plans you like after all, but if you've not got an anti-tank weapon that's going to do the job, you're screwed. And if you've not got an anti-tank weapon that's going to do the job, your men's morale will collapse. If they feel they aren't being properly equipped, if they feel they aren't being given the tools to do the job, well, they can't do the job. So they feel like no one they feel like no one cares about them. They feel like they aren't, that their command doesn't have their best interests at heart.
If you're given and yet you have a number of units who fight absolutely phenomenally
well
such as the South Notts Hussars, for example.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, who are destroyed in the Cauldron, or Knights, which I can't remember which one, but you know, they're utterly destroyed, but they literally do fight to the last man.
Yeah.
There's no running away for them or hander-hocking.
Yeah. But I would say to anybody, if you can get hold of a copy of this, it's really amazing. The stuff before Alamein is, this is an amazing sentence, right? When we did eventually meet the Americans, we were impressed throughout by the way they always turned to machines, even to the designing of new machines, whenever the new problem presented itself, in order to save manpower, sweat, and blood.
Yeah, there you are. What page is British, that?
We British warriors, that's page 209. We British warriors have always relied on the man's skill to overcome our battlefield problems, a thoroughly foolish habit in an industrial world and age.
Yeah. That's a great line, isn't it?
The most glaring example of this was to match the 303 rifle, Mad Minute, against the German medium machine gun in 1914. Thereafter, to stick stubbornly to the bayonet and all it implied for the rifleman walking. Bayonet fixed at the port into the spray of submachine guns with the optimistic intention of spiking the gunners. Was there more than an error? It was a crime. It was mass homicide. Never and never must we commit similar crimes. Yet today we watch our army hovering close to another folly, egged on to demand heavy conventional weapons on a model battlefield in a nuclear era. I mean, one of the other things this book is tone, right, is you can see why Francis Tuca may have been sent out to command a series of last posts. It's like Orkin thing. Oh, for God's sake, he's in my ear again. Because he goes to Auchinleck and says, you should be out there fighting this battle.
You should be doing this. This is what you want to be doing.
He begs him. He goes and pleads with him to go. And he won't. And obviously Auchinleck, I can't do that, you know. And it's like, yeah, there's all sorts of things going on in this first half of 1942, aren't there? There's the kit isn't up to the job because the terrain is different. You know, the two pounder is a perfectly good anti-tank gun if you're fighting in Northwest Europe, isn't it? But they're not. The tanks are fine in temperate climes, but they're not in temperate climes. You know, they've been designed for, again, all the gear's been designed for somewhere else. And they're, although the German gear has all been designed for somewhere else, is the other, the riposte.
But they've got more 3.7 inch anti-aircraft guns in Egypt than Rommel has in the entire Panzer.
Yes, I know, but you know, anti-aircraft, that's very important, Jim. Anti-aircraft.
How many times the Luftwaffe flying over Alexandria and Cairo?
That's the anti-aircraft gun's really good. It stopped them.
It's just painful. It's absolutely painful. I mean, this book is just full of great, great liners, isn't it? In war, it is wiser to use a hammer to swat a fly than a fly swat to hammer a hornet. That's like Asterix in Britain.
That's a great quote.
Your rain may be larger than my garden, but my pilum is stronger than your sternum.
That is absolutely like a t-shirt, isn't it?
We've got to have that. I want that. Can we get a Tuca t-shirt?
I think so. I mean, the story at the end of when he takes von Armin's surrender is fantastic as well.
Oh, isn't it good? It's so good.
Who basically is freaking out because there are Indian soldiers Tukas an Indian army formation, and von Armin's like, I can't surrender to Indians, and Tukas like, you'll surrender to whoever, you know, I'm not interested, mate.
Yeah, and refuses to shake his hand and all that kind of
exactly,
stuff.
Takes his pistol. It's absolutely.
We have been talking for a long time, and there's also that brilliant description of Nigel Nicholson.
Yeah.
Who is in the Coldstream Guards at the time? Or is he Grenadier Guards? He's in the Grenadier Guards.
Yeah.
And it's after the Battle of Majerda, and it's near the end, and he's on a road, and suddenly Field Marshal Alexander's car comes by.
Yeah.
And he stops, and he sees this dead Italian and a machine gun by the side of the road. Yeah. And he gets out and kicks the machine gun into the ditch, then gets back into his car and drives off. It's just absolutely brilliant. But we're jumping the gun here because obviously Tobruk then, you know, the whole Gazala line completely collapses. And once the Gazala line collapses, it's writing on the wall time for Tobruk. And units are just streaming back at this point. I mean, it is, you know, all cohesion has gone.
Yeah.
The British are just fleeing for their lives. And Tobruk falls on the 21st of June when Churchill is in Washington having talks with Roosevelt. And it's this moment of deep, yes, dull is an understatement. and what absolutely you say to him, I mean, the good thing is, and this is why I've been very careful about saying it's the British Army, it's not the British Armed Forces. The Navy is absolutely superb throughout in evacuating Tobruk. And the evacuation of Tobruk from the port and everything is just brilliantly done by the Royal Navy, Mediterranean Fleet. But also, of course, it's the Desert Air Force. It's their coming of age moment. It's a moment where all those plans that have been laid by Tedder and by Arthur Cunningham in the autumn of 1941 absolutely reach their apogee with the leapfrogging, with the organisation of spares, with the organisation of how you actually structure your squadrons and your wings and all that kind of stuff. And they're able to hammer the Panzer Army 24/7 pretty much as they're trying to pursue Eighth Army in retreat, and it just completely holds them up and attrits them in a really, really massive
way. Now that raises a question: the RAF, right? They've kept their best people in England, right? As far as they see it, haven't they?
No,
do you know what I mean?
Yes, except they're not. They're their most useless.
But that's exactly my
fighters.
No, but this is my point. The RAF thinks it's got our best chaps are in London. We're keeping our best people in England. And, you know, our fighter command people, the absolute top of the shop, and they're the people who won the Battle of Britain, and they prove the point of the existence of the RAF, why it's separate from the army and why it does its own thing, why does it get tangled up with the army and all that. And the people in North Africa are actually the people doing the sort of the really important joining up that needs to happen.
Yes.
And are they regarded as the RAF's best people, or have they been sent to North Africa because they need to be kept out of?
Well, I think when Tedder,
do you see what I mean?
Exactly what I mean. Yeah, I do. And I think when Tedder gets posted to Middle East Command, RAF Middle East, I think he is considered a pretty top draw person.
Right. Okay.
I think he is.
He's been given. It's not like Hugh Pugh Lloyd, where it's like send him to Malta.
No. Because don't forget, Hugh Pugh Lloyd is sent there quite early on, and that's I think still in maybe early 1941 or something, where they're still kind of floundering around. But Tedder goes out sort of mid 1941.
But do you know what I mean?
Cunningham gets there in September, I think.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean, and I think the point is that is where the action's happening. Okay, they're doing rhubarbs and stuff across the channel. They're doing channel sweeps or whatever, but not an awful lot is happening. And obviously, Bomber Commander is still sort of reeling from the Butt report and is trying to get itself together. And in February 1942, Harris takes over command of Bomber Command.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a work in progress.
Yeah.
But in terms of the development of close air support and tactical air power, that's all happening in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And what happens over the next 8 months, 8 to 9 months, is this honing of air power as the Americans arrive. Because 8th Air Force has arrived in August 1942 into UK, and then most of it has been stripped out and sent to the Mediterranean for North Africa, Operation Torch and so on.
Yeah.
And so you get the North African, the Allied North African Tactical Air Force, which is the first tactical air force that's ever created by the Allies. And And suddenly you've got all these right people in theatre. So you've got Jimmy Doolittle, you've got Tui Spots, you've got Larry Kuta, you've got Brereton, you've got Tedder, yeah. you've got Pete Casada, you've got yeah. And you've got John Slessor, all these guys who are all there is this spirit of we are pioneers. Yeah. We're all in this together. And isn't this exciting? What the possibilities are.
That theatre benefits from being somewhere where ambitious people who want to do well know that they can thrash a thing out, and the money's basically the money's being spent there. So it's
it is after Tobruk, because what everyone realizes is, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
A, sending Spitfires to Malta has completely worked. There were the naysayers who saying that doesn't, because they first arrive in March and then decent numbers by the beginning of May.
Yeah.
And what their arrival coincides with the bugging out of the Luftwaffe from Sicily for the Gazala operation.
Yeah.
You know, because the Luftwaffe doesn't have enough resources to be in two places at once. So you can't be in North Africa and in Sicily, pounding Malta. So they bug out. So there were lots of people who were going, if you send Spitfires to Malta, they won't work because they're too delicate, they're too thoroughbred, and they'll get, you know, hammered by sand. And that doesn't happen. They've got Vokes filters and all the stuff helping sort of counteract that.
Yeah.
And then there is the role of the Desert Air Force in saving the bacon of 8th Air Force. And no one is denying that. No one denies that the reason that 8th Army gets back into some kind of order behind the Alamein line at the beginning of July 1942 is because the Desert Air Force has harried and hounded the pursuing Panzer Army with great skill and brilliance. And that's why they're able to get away. And everyone knows that. And everyone completely gets this brilliant integration of air power with the land operation. And so huge amount of resources are thrown at it, and very effectively too. And to give credit where credit's due, I mean, Monty is the first person, having taken over command of 8th Army and then overseen Alam Halfa and then obviously the Second Battle of Alamein, he's the first to go, we couldn't have done it without the RAF.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because then when you get further east, that this stuff all isn't happening yet. You know, what's happening in Burma in 1942 is like relentlessly poor and another massive failure of command. I mean,
that's also another reason why Rommel is able to counterattack at the beginning of 1942 is because lots of supplies that were going to go to the desert are being diverted to the Far East, including a few Americans.
What's happening in Burma at this period is entirely unedifying. Obviously by May the monsoon's starting, so things are sort of tailing off.
Nothing happens between May and November. It's all kind of quiet time.
But it's really terrible. What the British Army's been through and the Indian Army's been through.
Yes.
In Burma And again, there's no one there that the ambitious people haven't got hold of it yet, have they? The clever people haven't got hold of the situation yet.
Well, there's a few out there.
Slim isn't in the ascendancy yet. No. You know, is basically what it comes down to. I think we've kicked this ball around a fair bit. I think we've got to come back to Francis Tuca. What I might do is stick a chapter up on the Patreon because it's very entertaining.
Well, I think that's a really good idea. But what I'm very keen to do, and we've been talking about it for a long time, is to do that. I think we should, you know, from time to time, I think it'd be really good to do real in-depth double whammy. So two podcast studies of particular battles. It might be a sea battle. It might be an air battle. It might be a ground battle. But I'm very keen to do Majerda. But I think we need to clear some stuff first out of the way.
Okay.
You've got to finish touring. I've got to get...
Yes, this is true. The Desert Champion. I'll do Chapter 10, The Desert Championship, third round. That's what I'll do. I'll record that at some point.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. Good idea.
Because it's good very, idea. Very, 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 very Tukery. Right, well, everybody, thanks very much for listening. Get your We Have Ways Fest tickets at wehavewaysfest.co.uk. We will see you all again really soon. Thanks very much for listening, everybody. Bye bye.
Cheerio.